There will be a discussion as to what has to be learned and what hardships have to be undergone, for it is a sad fact that hardship, 78, teaches one more quickly and more permanently than does kindness. It is also worthy of note that it does not at all mean that because a person is at present in a lowly position that that person is lowly in the spirit world. Often a person will be in a menial position in a certain life in order that specified lessons may be learned, yet in the life to be the person may be a high entity indeed. It is unfortunate that upon earth a person is judged by the amount of money he has, by what his parents were, and this, of course, is tragically absurd. It is much the same as judging a schoolboy, or his progress, by how much money his father has instead of judging the boy by his own progress. We repeat that no one has so far succeeds in taking even one single penny beyond the barrier of death, but all knowledge is taken, every experience undergone is stored and taken away into the life beyond. Thus, those who think that because they have a million or so they are going to get a front seat in heaven, are going to be sadly and unpleasantly mistaken. Money, position, race and color do not matter in the slightest, the only thing that matters is the degree of spirituality which one has reached. To return to our spirit about to enter into another incarnation, when suitable parents have been found, then, at the appropriate time, the spirit will enter into the forming body of the unborn infant, and with the entering into the body there will become an instant erasure of the conscious memories of the life beyond such entering. It would of course be a terrible thing if the baby had a memory of when he was, perhaps, very closely, very intimately related to his mother or his father. It would be tragic and painful if the baby could remember that in the past life he was a great king, and now he was the poorest of the poor. For that reason, among many others, it is an act of mercy that the average person cannot remember his or her past life, but when they once again pass through this life and return to the spirit world everything, is remembered. Many people adhere most rigidly to the old statement "Honor thy father and thy mother." While this is indeed a most laudable feeling, it should be made clear that many people upon earth will never again see their father or their mother when they enter into the spirit world. In the old days it was very necessary that the priests do, 79, everything possible to gain the cooperation of parents in order that young men and young women did not leave the tribes, because the wealth of tribes in those days rested in the young people. The more numerous the tribe, the more easily could they overcome small tribes. Thus it was that the priests exhorted children to obey the parents, and the parents in particular obeyed the priests. Let us state quite definitely that we do indeed agree that parents should be honored provided they merit it. We also state that if a parent is overbearing or unkind or tyrannical, then that parent has rejected and spurned all rights to be honored. There is no need whatever for the slavish obedience which some children give to their parents. Some children are adult and married, and have perhaps lived half a century on their own, yet they still tremble with fear or apprehension when the name of a parent is mentioned. Frequently it leads to a neurosis, and instead of commanding love there is perhaps fear and ill-concealed hatred. Yet these children, perhaps half a century or more of age, feel guilt because they have been brought up to the belief, "Honor thy father and thy mother." For those so afflicted we would like to say again quite definitely, quite emphatically, that if you are unhappy with your parents you will never see them again in the spirit world. In the spirit world there is the law of harmony, and it is utterly impossible for you to meet anyone with whom you are incompatible. Thus, if you are married to a partner and yours is a marriage of convenience, a marriage which you are afraid to break for fear of what the neighbors will say, you will never again meet your partner in the spirit world unless he or she alters so radically, or if you alter, that you are both compatible. We must again repeat, so that there is no possibility of misunderstanding, if you and your parents are incompatible, if you do not get on, if you are not happy together, if you are not suited to each other, then you will not meet on any other plane of existence. The same applied to relatives, or husband and wife. They must definitely be compatible and in complete harmony before they can meet again. This is one of the reasons why it is necessary for spirits to have a physical body, that lessons may be learned, because only in the physical body can two antagonistic entities be brought into contact so that they may, 80, try to smooth off the rough edges and reach mutual understanding. Later, in another lesson, we shall deal with the problems of God or gods, and of different forms of religious belief. Humans mistakenly think that they are of the greatest form of existence. That is quite incorrect, and again it is an idea fostered by organized religions. Religious thought teaches one that man is made in the image of God. Therefore, if man is made in the image of God, there can be nothing higher than man. Actually, on other worlds there are some very, very high forms of life. God is not a benevolent old gentleman who peers at us kindly through the pages of some book. God is a very real thing, a living spirit who guides us all, but not necessarily in the way that we have been taught. Finally, in this lesson, think over your own relationship with your parents, or with your partner, or with your relations. Are you happy with them? Are you, really? Or are you living apart? Could you contemplate living with any of these people permanently throughout the rest of existence? Remember when you were at school, there were a number of people in the class with you, there were teachers. You had to pay respect to the teachers, but they are not permanently associated with your life, they were temporary measures, people appointed to supervise your education. Your parents also are people whom you have chosen, with their permission in the spirit world, to sponsor and supervise your development. If people sincerely love their parents, and not because some religious teaching tells them they should, then they will indeed have the greatest joy of all in knowing that they will definitely meet their parents on the other side. Conditions on the other side will be what you here on earth make them. Lesson 14. All of us are anxious to get things done for us, to get things given to us. Probably everyone would admit to having prayed for assistance. It is, of course, a natural thing in human affairs to want the assistance of someone else. Man feels insecure alone and wants the godfather image or the mother image in order that he may feel protected, may feel that he is one of a great family. But in order that one may receive, 81, one must first give. You cannot receive without giving, for the act of giving, the attitude of opening the mind, makes it possible for you to be receptive to those who are willing to give what you want to receive. When we say give, we do not necessarily mean money, although it is usual to give money, because that to most people is what they desire above all else. Money at the present time signifies security from want, relief from the fear of starvation, freedom from the visits of the debt collector. Money can be given, and must be given under certain conditions, but give also means to give of oneself, to be willing to be of service to others. We can, and must, give money or goods or assistance or spiritual consolation to those who need them. Again, unless we give, we cannot receive. There is much misconception about give, alms, begging, and similar matters relating to so-called charity in the Western world. It seems that people imagine that there is something shameful, something degrading in having to solicit assistance from another one. But this is definitely not the case. Money is merely a commodity which is lent to us while upon the earth. It is a commodity with which we can buy happiness and self-advancement by helping others with that money instead of hoarding it uselessly in some dead stone vault. This, unfortunately, is the world of commerce, where a man's measure is taken by the money that he has in his bank and by the outward show he makes with that money. The flashily dressed man or the woman who gives for his own satisfaction, to build up a false facade, is not a spiritual man nor a generous man. He is a man who is spending without any thought of giving. He is spending selfishly that his own ego may be bolstered. In the Western world, a man is judged by how well his wife dresses, what sort of a car he drives, what sort of a house he occupies. Does he belong to this or that club? Then he must be a man of substance, because only those in the millionaire class can belong to that club. Again, this is a world of false values, for, let us repeat it endlessly so that it sinks into your subconscious, no man or woman has ever succeeded in taking even one penny or one pin, or even a spent match beyond the river of death. All that we can take is that contained within our knowledge, all that we can take is the sum total of our experiences, good and bad, generous and mean, which will be distilled down so that, 82, only the essence of those experiences remains. And the man who lived for himself alone upon the earth, although upon the earth he was perhaps a millionaire, when he goes to the other side he will be a spiritual bankrupt. In the East it is a common sight indeed for the housewife to go to her door at the close of day and find there the robed monk with his humble begging bowl. This is so much a part of life in the East that every housewife sees to it, no matter how poor she may be, that she has food to spare for the mendicant monk who depends upon her generosity. It is considered an honor indeed to the house that a monk should call for sustenance, but contrary to common belief in the West, a monk is not just a parasite or beggar. He is not a shiftless man who is afraid to work and sow lives on the bounty of others. Do you know what it is like, these evening scenes in the East? Let us assume that we are looking down in the East upon some country such as India, where this process of giving to the monks is common indeed, as it was in China and Tibet before the communists seized power. We are, then, looking down on a village in India. The evening shadows are falling and lengthening across the ground. The light is taking on a bluish-purplish tinge, the leaves of the baobab trees are rustling slightly as the night winds come along from the Himalayas. Softly along the dusty road comes a monk dressed in tattered robes, carrying with him all that he possesses in the world. He has his robe, with sandals upon his feet, in his hand he carries his rosary. Slung across his shoulder he has his blanket which serves him as his bed. Other small possessions are tucked into his robe. In his right hand he has a staff, not to defend himself against animals or humans, but that he may push aside brambles and branches which otherwise would impede his progress. He uses it, too, to test the depths of a river before he attempts to ford it. He approaches a house. As he does so he fumbles in the breast of his robe and produces his well-worn, shiny bowl, a wooden bowl which is aged and worn smooth with use. As he approaches the house the door is suddenly opened and a woman stands respectfully at the entrance with a dish of food in her hands. Modestly she looks down, not gazing at the monk, for that would be an impertinence. She looks down to, 83, show that she is modest, demure, and of a good name. The monk walks up to her and holds his bowl with two hands. Of course, in the East one always holds a bowl or a cup with two hands because to hold it with one hand only would show disrespect to the food. Food is precious, therefore it is worthy of the attention of two hands. So, the monk holds his bowl steady with two hands. The woman puts in a generous supply of food, and then turns away. No word is exchanged, no glance is given. For to feed a monk is an honor, not a burden. To feed a monk is to pay to some small extent the debt which all lay people feel toward those who are in holy orders. The woman of the house feels that she and her house have been paid respect, that this, a holy man, has called at her door. She feels that tribute has been paid to her cooking. She wonders if some other monk may perhaps have said some kind words about the food which she has provided, and this had sent another monk to her door. In other houses women may be looking rather jealously out from their curtained windows, wondering why they have not been chosen for the monk's visit. With his bowl filled, the monk slowly turns away still holding the receptacle with two hands, and moves across the road again to the shelter of some friendly tree. There he will sit, as he has sat for most of the day, and have his evening meal, the only meal of the day. Monks do not overeat. They live frugally and have just enough to maintain their strength and their health, but they do not have sufficient to make them become gluttonous. Too much food clogs the spiritual development, too rich food or fried foods impair the physical health, and, if one is to develop spiritually, one should live as the monks live, eat enough but no more, eat plainly that the body may be fed but do not eat richly so that the mind is satiated and the spirit locked in the case of clay. It should be explained that the monk who has had this food does not necessarily feel overcome with gratitude. Through time immemorial a way of life has arisen in the East. A monk is fed as a right. He is not a beggar, not a burden. He is not a shiftless man nor a parasite. During the day, before the evening meal, the monk will have been sitting for hours beneath a tree, available to all who comes his way, available to all who need his services. Those who need spiritual solace, 84, will have come to him for help, as will those who have relations who are ill, or even those who want an urgent letter written. Some, too, come to see the monk, to hear if he has any news of loved ones in some far distant place, for a monk is always on the move, walking from town to town, from city to city, traversing the countryside, crossing the land from border to border. And the monk gives his services free, no matter what is wanted of him, no matter how long the service demanded takes, it is free. He is a holy man and an educated man. He knows that many of the villagers who need him and the help that he willingly proffers, cannot pay him, they are too poor, wherefore it is right and just that as he has had to study for his knowledge, and as he brings spiritual consolation to people, he has not the time nor the right to work manually and earn a living. Therefore it becomes the duty, the privilege and the honor that those whom he has assisted shall in their turn assist him and pay to some small extent with the food which he has to keep body and soul together. After his meal the monk will rest a while, and then, rising to his feet and cleaning his bowl with fine sand, he will pick up his staff and stride off into the night, often travelling beneath the light of a brilliant tropical moon. The monk travels far and fast, and sleeps little. He is a man respected throughout the Buddhist countries. We, too, should be willing to give in order that we may receive. In the days of long ago it was a divine law that all men should give a tenth of their possessions that good may thereby be wrought. This tenth became known as a tithe, and soon it became an integral part of life. In England, for example, the churches could levy a tithe on all property, on everything that a person possessed. This money was devoted to the upkeep of the church and provided the stipend of the incumbents of a living. It is interesting to note that some 10 years ago in England there were a number of law cases where hereditary landlords made a great commotion in the law courts of the land in order that the tithes imposed by the Church of England should be set aside. The hereditary landlords were complaining that having to pay a tenth of their income was ruining them. Actually, they were being ruined by not giving willingly, for unless one gives willingly it is better not to give at all. Nowadays standards are rather different from what they were years, 85, ago. No longer do people live on tithes nor do they pay tithes, and that is a pity. It is essential that if one is going to progress spiritually one shall tithe for the good of others, and especially as for the good of others brings much good to oneself. In short, we can only progress and be helped if we help others. We are aware of a number of very hard-headed businessmen of no great spiritual leaning who willingly give a tenth of their income for the good of others, and, more especially, for their own good. They do it not because they are religious, they do it because hard commercial experience and the facts of account books have taught them that in thus casting their bread upon the waters it comes back to them a thousandfold. Money lenders, who in some parts of the world are referred to as financial corporations, are not always noted for spirituality nor for generosity, and it seems to us that if even one of these money-lender financial gentlemen has sufficient faith in tithing then there must indeed be something very profitable in the scheme, and we know that many many hard-headed businessmen do just this. The occult laws apply to the unspiritual as much as they do to the spiritual. It does not matter if a person studies a lot and reads a lot of spiritual books. That does not make a person spiritual. He might be just reading and deluding himself into thinking he is spiritual. The matter which he is reading may pass straight through his eyes and vanish into thin air without having once impinged upon the memory cells of his brain, yet this person will refer to himself as a great soul and really believe that he is making progress. Actually, he is usually very self-righteous and very unwilling to help others, even though in helping others he would greatly help himself. We repeat again that it is right and proper and profitable that a person shall give help to others. Incidentally, it is very helpful to the person who gives. Tithe means, as we have said, a tenth. It also means a way of life, because if one gives one also receives. We have in mind as we write a person who was given much help, much assistance, help and assistance which cost money, time, and specialized knowledge. As fast as one trouble was cleared up for that person other troubles descended like a, 86, flock of starlings in a newly seeded field. We said in order to receive you must first give. The person was most offended, and gave us to understand that he was most generous and did everything possible to help others, as the local newspapers would attest. Our contention is that if a person has to have good deeds reported in the local newspapers, then that person is not giving in the correct way. There are many ways in which we can give. We can, in addition to devoting a tenth of our income to good work, help others in their spiritual needs, or help them by the necessary consolation when they fall upon evil times. In giving to others, we give unto ourselves. Just as a business must have a good turnover in order that business may prosper, so must we have a good turnover of giving in order that we may receive. We must give to help others, we must give in order that we may be helped. It is useless to pray that something be given to you unless you first show that you are worthy by giving to those who need it. Practice it, practice giving, decide how much you can give, what you can give, and how, and having worked out how and why and when, put it into practice, try it for 3 months. You will find that at the end of 3 months you are in pocket either spiritually or financially, or both. Will you study this, and study it again? And remember, give that ye may receive, cast your bread upon the waters. Lesson 15. It is an old custom throughout the world to store one's love treasures in the attic, treasures which one holds onto for old time's sake. Often they will lie half forgotten in the attic until, probably when one is searching for something else, one goes up those usually difficult stairs and prowls about in the dusty, musty, cobweb-laden semi-darkness. Here is the old dressmaker's dummy reminding one irresistibly of the passage of years, for a dress made on that would no longer fit. There may be a case, or more than a case, of old letters. What are they, tied with blue ribbon? Or pink? As one looks about, one comes across things, 87, which one had almost forgotten, things which revive affectionate memories and revive memories of sad times too. Do you often prowl about in your attic? It is worth a visit every so often, for some useful things are stored in attics, things which bring back one's memories, things which add up to one's general knowledge. Problems which confronted us in days gone by may have been swept aside effortlessly by newfound knowledge, by experiences gained, lessons learned, through the passage of the years. But in this particular lesson, we are not going to ask you to go into your attic. We are going to suggest that you come with us, follow us up the winding wooden stairs with the old handrail at the side, go up those creaking wooden stairs which makes one feel that they are going to break through at any moment, but they never do. Come with us into our attic, browse around, for this lesson and the one after will be in the rooms of our attic. In it we have all sorts of little pieces of information which may not necessarily fit into a separate lesson, but they will be of undoubted interest to you and value. So think about our attic, read on and see how much of this applies to you, how much of it clears up little doubts, little uncertainties which may have nagged at your mind or plagued you for some time. We browsed about quite a bit while we were preparing this lesson, we poked around in various odd corners, upsetting quite a few theories and raising a lot of dust. We concentrated on the people who concentrate too much. You can work too hard, you know. We are quite aware of the old saying, a man was never killed by too much hard work, but we maintain that if one works too hard at concentrating, then one travels backwards. In our work we frequently get letters from students who say, but I try so hard, I concentrate and concentrate, and all I get is a headache. I do not get any of the phenomena that you mention. Yes, that is a little treasure that we may stop a while and examine. One can often try too hard. It is a quirk of humanity, or, possibly more accurately, a fault of the human brain, that if one tries too hard one makes no progress whatsoever. In fact, in trying too hard one sets up what can only be termed as a negative feedback. We all know the stodgy fellow who really plods on through life always trying and trying, and trying far harder than anyone else would, but he never gets, 88, anywhere. He is always in a state of confusion, of uncertainty. Again, when we overtax our brains we generate an excess charge of electricity that actually inhibits further thought. You may not be an electronics engineer, but if electronics and electricity were used in the study of human brains, then those studies would be greatly facilitated. The human brain has much in common with electronics. Do you know, for instance, how the ordinary radio tube works? There is a filament which is heated by a battery or from the mains. That filament, being heated, gives off electrons in a completely uncontrolled manner. The electrons flow off, they stream off like a maddened crowd going to a football match. If these electrons are allowed to roam without being controlled in any way, then they are quite useless in radio or electronics. In a tube we have a glass envelope. The filament is in the envelope and as it gets hot the electrons are radiated everywhere, but that is useless. We want those electrons to be collected on what is known as a plate which is in close proximity to the filament. As things are, if there was only the filament and the plate the process of collecting the electrons would be wild, uncontrollable, there would be distortion of a radio program or whatever it was we were trying to receive. Engineers found that if they interposed what they termed a grid between the filament and the plate, and they introduced onto the grid a negative current, then they could control the flow of electrons between filament and plate. So this grid, which is indeed a grid, it is often a wire mesh, acts as what is known as a grid bias. If one applies too much grid bias, then no electrons will flow from the filament onto the plate, they are all repelled by the grid. By altering the grid bias to a suitable value the control can be as desired. Back to our brain before you are tired of radio. When we concentrate too much, when we really bend our brains to a problem, we all too frequently apply negative grid bias which has the effect of inhibiting thought completely. So we must not try too hard, we must be sensible about it, we must at all times remember the old Chinese adage softly, softly catch a monkey. We must go about our concentration in such a manner that our brains do not become tired. Do only that which is within your capacity, take the middle way. The middle way is an Eastern way of life. It means that you do not, 89, have to be too bad, but on the other hand you do not have to be too good, you have to be something in between. If you are too bad the police will get you, if you are too good, then you will be a stuffed prig or you will be unable to stay upon this earth. Because it is a fact that even great entities who come to this sad world of ours have to take some form of disability, some quirk of character, so that while upon earth they are not perfect, for nothing perfect can exist upon this imperfect world. Once again, do not try too hard, try to do a thing naturally, within reason, within your capacity. You do not have to go round offering slavish adherence to anything said by others. Use your common sense. Adapt a thing or a statement to suit yourself. We might say this is a red cloth, but you might see it differently, to you it might be pink or orange or even a light purple, it depends upon the conditions under which you saw that cloth, your lighting may be different from our lighting, your sight may be different from ours. So do not try too hard, nor adhere too slavishly to anything. Use common sense, use the middle way is a very very useful thing. Try this middle way, it is the way of tolerance, the way of respecting the rights of others and of getting your own rights respected. In the East priests and others study judo and other forms of wrestling, not because the said priests are belligerent, but because in learning judo and similar forms of fighting one learns to control oneself, one learns self-restraint, and above all one learns to give way in order that one may win. Take judo. In this one does not use one's own strength in order to win a battle, one uses the opponent's strength in order that he may be defeated. Even a very small woman knowing judo can defeat a hulking great brute of a man who does not. The stronger the man, the more fiercely he attacks, the easier it is to defeat him because his own strength causes him to fall more heavily. Let us use judo or the strength of the opposition in order to overcome our problems. Do not tire yourself or wear yourself out, think out a problem that is bothering you, do not evade the issue as do so many people. Many people are afraid to look at a problem, they skirt around the edges of the problem probing tentatively but never getting anywhere. No matter how unpleasant a subject is, no matter how guilty, 90, you may feel about a thing, get right down to the root of your problem, find out what it is that troubles you, that frightens you. Then when you have discussed with yourself every aspect of the problem sleep on it. If you sleep on a thing, it will be passed to your overself, who has much greater understanding than you have, for the overself is a great entity indeed compared to the human body.